This is The Guardian.
Hello, Grace Dent here with news. I've been cooking up fresh episodes of my podcast Comfort Eating, and they are now ready to be devoured. Chock full of chat and brimming with autumn cheer. Join me as I talk to the likes of Stanley Tucci, Vanessa Feltz, Richard E. Grant and Rag & Bone Man about life, love and the grub that has seen them through. New episodes every Tuesday. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. Chelsea now just 4 points off the top of the Premier League after a 4-3 win at Spurs. Anyone taking them seriously? Or is a Chelsea win when Spurs are 2-0 up after 11 minutes just the most likely outcome? Forest win at Old Trafford, which on the pitch looked quite a lot like the Manchester United players' fault, but in actual fact was Dan Ashworth's fault. He departs by some not very mutual consent. Manchester City dropped points at Palace. Is that even a story anymore while Arsenal are held at Fulham? Two stirring Sunday comebacks by Leicester and Bournemouth, and then there's Brentford's ludicrous home form and Aston Villa beating Southampton. Also today we carry on our discussion on LGBTQ plus allyship, refusing to wear the rainbow armband and respecting cultures after some criticism from last week. All that plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning, welcome.
Hi Max.
Will Unwin, hello.
Hello Max.
Hello Lars Hivertsen.
Hello.
And joining us for two interesting and perhaps difficult conversations, Chris Powerross, Spurs fan. What's your title, Chris, of the Proud Lily Whites? Do you run it all now?
I'm the co-chair and a co-founder, yes. And good morning, everyone.
All right. Well, look, we'll get to Spurs, Chris. You were there. But, you know, a moment to work on, because I know you're a very positive Tottenham fan, full of hope. You've got a few minutes to just, like, think about how you can spin this. But we probably should start with Chelsea, Barry, because this actually is a huge win for them to come back from two down. Lots of big moments where this game could go either way, but they were the better, more controlled team in a sort of very uncontrolled, balmy football match.
Yeah, I think their midfields are what win you games, I suppose, and their midfield was strongest throughout. And when things weren't working for them, Enzo Maresco made changes. When things weren't working for Tottenham, Ange Postecoglou didn't make changes, because he doesn't game, I mean. And I think that's what ultimately won it for Chelsea. I actually thought Spurs would win this game beforehand, and then when they went 2-0 up, I was like, they're feeling quietly smug. But they never really looked safe. I think ultimately Chelsea were more than deserving winners. But how much of this you pin on Ange, I don't really know, because the two penalties Tottenham gave away were just ridiculous, just mindless acts of stupidity, which you can't really lay at the manager's door.
Self-harm.
Think Bissouma's still sliding. He's still sliding into Connor Cody, who's still sliding after Minter, like just turned him inside out. They're going to meet each other, aren't they? Somewhere between North London and wherever that game was, Leicester. Now, I agree with you, Baz. It is impossible, actually, to talk about this game without talking about Tottenham, isn't it, really? I mean, I know the Sancho goal is brilliant, and I wonder if Chelsea don't get back into it that quickly. Perhaps it's a different game, you know, and the Panenka from Palmer. It's so slow that Fraser Forster has time to get up and just watch it go in, doesn't it? Come on then, Chris, how are you?
I'm all right. Look, watching Spurs is like watching basketball, and it's great fun. But it's, you know, high risk, high reward. I mean, I could trot out as many cliches as you like. I said to my nephew at 2-0 up, because I go to the game with my nephew, we're going to lose 6-2. So look, we didn't lose 6-2. It was 4-3. And Chelsea, we're not great against Chelsea. But, you know, as Baz just said, you know, actually, I'm not sure you necessarily put this at our door. Casado was lucky to be on the pitch. At 2-2, Sonny could have made it 3-2. And that, I think that would have changed it. You can't blame Ange for poor decision making of Bissouma and Pap Sarr. But the thing for me more recently is is I think there's something about the mentality of the players, because you could go in and like start like that against Chelsea.
More recently with Spurs and the mentality of the players.
Well, you know, I've got a short memory. I have to have a short memory, Max, yeah, I think is key. The important thing there. Like, and so, you know, to kind of lose against the teams that you think you should beat and then to come out and play like we have done against the likes of Manchester City, Manchester United, Villa, etc. I think what Ange just said is that he always wins a trophy in his second season. We're on track for that. I've already booked a hotel room in Bilbao, right?
Just unfortunately, you booked a hotel room in Bilbao on the date of the FA Cup final. I mean, I admire your hope. Lars, what did you make of all of this? I thought Barry made an interesting point that Maresca did tinker. You know, he took off Lavia, he brought on Gusto, he did those things and probably didn't necessarily have the bench to make such effective changes, but he doesn't change stuff.
No, I'm a little bit hesitant to go down the route of we can't blame Ange because the two penalties were crazy, because then at the same time we can't really give him credit for Mark Cucurella starting the game wearing bowling shoes, which is, you know, it's not really something that Ange deserves a lot of credit for. The Spurs were very aggressive and pressing in doing the stuff, but I was just kind of shocked by just there was no control over anything. And when you look at the lineup, No, James Maddison, and presumably you pick Sarr over Maddison because you want his sort of extra running power. You want to try to compete with Chelsea's midfield a little bit. But having made that call, there were still just wide open spaces at all times in the Tottenham midfield, which just kind of seems bad. And it seems like something that should be adjusted at some point. And I kind of, being a little bit harsh, yes, Son had that chance, but this also didn't seem like a game where Spurs were almost given two goals. I mean, it's a great finish by Kulusevski, but I mean, they get two goals from kind of bizarre, goofy mistakes. And after that, Chelsea were just the better team throughout, really, I thought. I was very, initially very frustrated about the fact that you rushed back to incredibly important players in Romero and Van de Ven, who were maybe not 100% ready to play, and both end up having going off. Some of them made me quite cross, but it has, I mean, it does transpire. I mean, it wasn't the same injury for Romero. It was a different injury. In Van de Ven, they say we're just tired. He hasn't been re-injured. So maybe that's not something, that's not a stake we can beat Postecoglou with. But it was, this is just a total chaos. I don't think this is intentional. We can talk about him being an ideologue and believing in the Ange ball and all this. I don't think it's meant to be this chaotic. I don't think the idea is to go out there and just have no semblance of control and just having the opponent run through your midfield constantly all the time. I really don't think that is the plan. So I don't think the plan is working that well. It's not just the ideology that's not working right now. It's the execution as well.
Is that down to Ange or the players then, Lars?
I'm not a super sort of savvy tactical analyst, but I don't think there's supposed to be this much space in the midfield constantly. I think there's something about the distances, like you're not meant to leave Cole Palmer in just an actual acre of space most of the time. Maybe some of that is the players getting some of the positioning wrong, but it isn't the first time we've seen Spurs be a little bit too easy to play through.
Is that, Will, because if you try and play this type of football when you are running on fumes, as Ange says, you're slightly off it. And if you're slightly off it in each bit of that, then the spaces are so much more evident.
Yeah, I'd just like to say there's one manager that I think might have filed down Cucurella's studs. I reckon Ange is keen for a prank. He's the one Premier League manager I think could do it. Obviously, you have to look at Spurs. They've scored more goals and conceded fewer than Man City, who are in fourth. I appreciate Man City are in crisis. But I just don't think they have the squad for it. They've got a very young squad. The midfield duo clearly got some issues with their thought processes, so it's obvious why there might be space. It's not just individual errors for penalties, it's across the board of where they are in their shape that they are giving so much space. And because they haven't got the squad, because they're playing Thursday nights, they are looking tired already. As you say, they've got defenders coming back who clearly aren't fit. I mean, Romero lasted 15 minutes. You know, it's not ideal. Dragosin doesn't look up to it every time I see him. I've seen him in the Europa League a few times and he just looks well off it. So there are deep concerns there. And I think when you recruit very young, like they have with Archie Gray, with Bergvall, that's great long term. So you've probably got to give Ange credit that he's looking at a bit more than, you know, this first 15 games. But the problems are there that the squad depth isn't available to Ange, and therefore maybe he needs to be a bit smarter of how he plays. It's absolutely fantastic. You've got a philosophy, mate, but if it's not working, you've got to adjust it a bit. You can't be 11th in the Premier League as Tottenham. And so you've seen other teams that have stuck to philosophies when they're not working and it doesn't end well. I think he's had pre-season to come up with more than one plan, and that's where you've got to be at the top level. You've got to have more than one plan. He doesn't seem to have it, and that's problematic, especially when you've got so many different, you know, you see how well they do against Man City, Man United, but then coming up short in other games, it shows that there are issues maybe with mentality, maybe with physical fitness. And if you have those two issues, you might need to have a more pragmatic approach at times when things aren't going right on the day. But he doesn't seem to have the ability just to tweak or adjust as other managers do.
I mean, Chelsea have to play in Kazakhstan later this week. They're almost going to be near China. But they can send an entire team of players to play that game in the Europa League, and it won't have any effect on their next Premier League side, or little or no effect. You know, that's how much strength and depth they have. Tottenham simply can't do something like that.
Yeah, just to build on to that, is I think part of the discussion over Ange Postecoglou right now and where they're at with the whole thing, you have to factor in the decision that they made in the summer of spending $70 million thereabouts on three teenagers. In Bergvall, Gray and Odeberg, and that in three, maybe if we have this conversation in 3 years' time, that will have been a great decision. It's entirely possible that two or all three of them turn out to be good Premier League players, and then that looks like a really clever, you know, decision showing a lot of foresight. But when you go that route, and instead of adding, you know, one really big signing or two sort of more proven squad players or options, you're going for three teenagers. At least for the first sort of 6 months, I think you need to bear in mind that, okay, the coach maybe doesn't have options that he would have otherwise had if they'd have gone in a different direction. And it's hard to know from the outside who was pushing for that to be the decision, but it was probably not Ange Postecoglou, I would hesitant to say.
Chris, of match-going fans, what is the vibe? Because, you know, people are saying he's under pressure, you know, if he has a bad few games, he should lose his job. I think they'd be mad now, given what they've invested in, to sack him.
That's definitely my position, Max. But I think in the stadium, it can feel a bit edgy. So it's on a knife edge at all times. Like between great excitement, it's like what's going on the pitch, right? Mm. It's like there's great excitement and then great misery. So, you know, the polarisation in the world is matched in the polarisation in the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium, right? You know, it was joyous for the first 15 minutes yesterday. There were a lot of complaints come 97 minutes. It's hard to say where the fan base is falling, because I think there are, exactly as we've heard today, there are different perspectives of some saying, look, we've just got to hold on, and others saying, you know, enough's enough. But what do we do? Just go on another 18-month cycle? I think we need to hold our nerve. I genuinely think we need to hold our nerve.
We'll obviously do more on Chelsea as the season progresses. They are 4 points off the top and probably deserve more airtime for that. But I want to keep you on, Chris, and talk about Friday's pod. We talked about the rainbow armband campaign. Ipswich captain Sam Morsy's refusal to wear the armband. Mark Gay writing Jesus loves you onto his. Nassiah Mazraoui refusing to wear a jacket depicting the rainbow colours. We received quite a lot of criticism after it was released. I'm going to read a couple of these. Thank you to everyone that did get in touch. We read all your emails, and everyone who wrote was incredibly thoughtful. This is from Samantha, who says, "Hi, Max and Barry. I've been a Football Weekly listener since 2012. I've always enjoyed your podcast. It's helped me through a number of hard times, including my struggles with depression recently coming out as a transgender woman. I've never felt the need to email before, but I wanted to let you know that I was quite disappointed about the conversation around the rainbow laces on this week's podcast. I understand this is an ongoing conversation, that faith is deeply important to the players involved, and a tolerant society respects that. However, I wish there'd been more focus given to how the discussion has impacted LGBTQ+ fans and players. It feels as though when it comes to inclusion in men's football, they come last. From conversations around World Cup host footballers moving to Saudi, and this week around captains refusing to wear the rainbow armband, there was no voice to express how queer Ipswich or Crystal Palace fans felt about this. If we're a universal game with the biggest dynamic of people across the globe, what about LGBTQ+ people? I simply don't believe this conversation was productive at a time when their rights are being rolled back in the UK. This from Rowan, who says, "Hi there. I think it's fair to say the armband in and of itself is a somewhat tokenistic gesture by clubs to show solidarity when more could be done, funding education programs, supporters groups, etc. But ultimately, visibility helps normalise sentiment, and pro-LGBTQI visibility at a national level, which helps show solidarity and consideration of people's lived experiences. To refuse to be part of this initiative is to say that you do not believe or tolerate queerness, as it is antithetical to your belief system, i.e. one that denies the rights and existence of queer people and their lives. The whole point of this initiative is to challenge that worldview. So if we are to give people a pass, whether Christian, Muslim, Hindu or any other faith, on the grounds of said faith, we are not challenging it at all. I understand the complexity of the subject and the need to support religious minorities at a time of global strife. But this isn't that. This transcends differing belief systems, as evidenced by Masrawi and Gay respectively. The general sentiment seemed to be, if they're not abusing or harming LGBTQI people, then why should they support the initiative, when surely the point is to challenge the opposition in the first place? People will always have different views, but if we deny rights and discriminate under the guise of religion, even if the individuals do not themselves discriminate, then not challenging them is problematic. Chris, you've listened to Friday's pod. I read your post on it. You've heard those two emails. I just wondered what you made of that conversation and what the reaction has been.
The one thing that sort of I've heard there, and I've heard amongst, you know, lots of kind of conversations that I've been in, is that we love football and we just want it to love us back. And, you know, the world does feel more volatile than ever, and LGBTQI plus communities are having their rights, we're having our rights rolled back all over the place. So to some degree, it might feel like an inconsequential spat in English football, but it can have like a much bigger impact, because the micro does affect the macro. And it hurts, because from, you know, lots of LGBTQI plus fans already feel marginalised in football. And some of this, you know, has definitely served to sort of further alienate us. And, you know, we've been talking about Spurs. You'll have seen yesterday an enormous progress flag at the corner of the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium. And, you know, on the one hand, you might say, well, that's just, you know, a tokenistic gesture. But actually, it's a hugely important symbol for LGBTQI plus Spurs fans. It's an unequivocal message that we're welcome and we belong. And you can't underestimate how that feels if you felt like you don't belong for so long. And all of this, I think, is about human rights. And it's not about denigrating anybody else's rights. So, you know, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights says that human rights are universal and inalienable, indivisible, interdependent and interrelated. So, and I think it's challenging, right? I think I understand the challenges around the sort of perceived clash with faith. I'm of the view that that's a sort of a false equivalence, because, as you know, as you saw on my post, it's like, I don't think they're in conflict. There are plenty of LGBTQI plus Christians, Muslims, Sikhs, etc. I think what can be challenging for some players is whether they might be putting themselves or their families in danger by wearing a rainbow symbol. And I think we have to take that seriously, because we're talking about rights being rolled back, people feeling safe, people feeling like they belong. But, you know, as you know, you saw, I think you read some of my posts on Friday's pod. And I think what's really important is that, you know, campaigns like Rainbow Laces are for life and not just for Christmas. So players need that time and space to explore ideas, ask questions and really understand what the bigger picture is. And that's how we build change. You know, it's not enough to say, here's an armband and wear it. You've got to give context, you know, just as I said, you know, like giving someone an armband without context, like giving them a user manual written in a different language. Got to understand why the campaigns matter. And then if they choose still not to wear it, then we can have a constructive conversation. But look, I think the other thing to remember is there are 20 Premier League captains. There were sort of issues, in inverted commas, with two of them. And, you know, 95% of the rest of the Premier League happily supported the campaign. I understand it. I understand those messages from Samantha and, sorry, I can't remember the other person's name.
Rowan was the other one.
From, yeah. Samantha and Rowan, because social belonging is like an essential human need. Maslow's hierarchy ranks our need for belonging on par with our need for love. So human beings are real social creatures. We crave that belonging. And football's not only our national game, it's how we learn to work, play, celebrate, commiserate together as children. It's about community, identity and belonging. And being part of something matters. So belonging in our national game matters. And because LGBTQI rights feel volatile, and because if you think about, you know, the Proud Lily White's been around for 10 years. Before then, we had no conversation around LGBTQI plus rights and football and inclusion, actually LGBTQI plus inclusion in football. So that's not very long, right? It's only a third of the Premier League. It's only, you know, of 150 years of football. So our sense of belonging can feel quite volatile. So all you need is something like this to go, oh my God, are they going to tell us that we shouldn't be here again? So I think I'll just go, I'll finish how we started, which is that we love football. We want it to love us back.
Chris, do you think, because that was a brilliant speech, you know, like should be, like felt like you should be like talking to like a huge crowd.
She is talking to a huge crowd, Max.
No, you are right. You are right. If a captain refuses to wear an armband, what do you think should happen? And also, what is the impact on, you know, not just LGBTQI plus fans of that club?
Well, can I just say, Max, I think a lot of this listener dissatisfaction stemmed from the fact I was about to raise a point, or trying to raise a point, that was, I think, most of the people who are unhappy with our discussion would have agreed with, but I was interrupted and I didn't make an effort to get back in and continue what I was trying to say. And that was, I thought the statement Ipswich put out, they were talking out of both sides of their mouth. You can't agree with the Rainbow Laces policy and also agree with your captain's decision not to wear an armband. I think, and it's a personal opinion, I thought the optics of one refusing to wear the rainbow armband, one putting Christian graffiti on his and the other refusing to wear a rainbow rain jacket or whatever, it looked homophobic, and they seemed to me to be using their religion as a shield behind which to hide, to demonstrate their homophobia. So I would like, if, you know, presumably there are staff and fans at Ipswich, Manchester United and Palace, probably even players as well, who are homosexual, I would like those guys to sit down with those people and explain their stance and have a conversation and go, this is why I, Sam Morrissey says, this is why I didn't wear an armband. Explain it to a gay person. That would be an interesting conversation to eavesdrop on.
You know, obviously I had to think about our friends at Proud and Palace, our friends at Rainbow Tractors, our friends at Rainbow Devils, and how they're having to navigate this. And I, you know, I appreciate that sort of it's not this straightforward in a first team environment, but I think in this context, I would have had, you know, you've got vice captains. I would have handed the armband off to somebody else, actually, because I think exactly to Baz's point, you either support the campaign or you don't from a club perspective. And, you know, your captain can be injured or can get dropped. So it's not like it's a fixed state of being a captain. And actually, you know, you're talking about inclusion. And as I said earlier, I don't want anybody to put themselves or their families in danger. And so on that basis, it's like you could just sort of say, actually, I'm not going to wear it this week. You have it, vice captain. And the conversations, I think, are a good idea. Whether the clubs sort of facilitate them or not, I don't know.
I think one of the interesting things, isn't it, that about football squads is they are so incredibly diverse with people with such varied backgrounds. You know, like wildly different upbringings can be in the same football squad. And if you sign a footballer from an incredibly conservative, be it Christian or Islamic community, somewhere in some other part of the world that has very different sensibilities and sensitivities, the football club then is in a really interesting and perhaps difficult position, because what they want is to make a footballer good at football and get them really fit. And this is not the same for Mark Gay and Sam Morrissey, right? You know, lived in England their whole lives. That's different. But on those cases, I just wonder, you know, is it a football club? What does a football club do to kind of say, right, this is the custom of this country, or, you know, we respect your culture, but this is, you know, how much time do they practically have to do all, in a sort of totally practical sense, to do all of that stuff? Or is that giving footballers a pass? They're humans like we are. We're all humans. We all move about. We should be able to, you know, is it too patronising to keep talking about educating footballers?
I think it's probably a bit of both, because again, I think if you look at those first team environments, like how much of these conversations are they actually have in a meaningful way? And, you know, there is a bit of time for it. I appreciate that, you know, you need to make sure you've got rest and recovery and that you're spending your time doing your work in the right way. But actually, there should be some time for this, because you do also operate in a world, you know, with whether we like it or not, you are role models. And I know there's a, you know, that could be a challenging statement to make in any case. But actually, you need to spend some time on that. And it's not necessarily for, you know, in some contexts, you might say it's for people that have come from other countries and cultures. But, you know, exactly as what you've just said with Sam Morsi and Mark Gay, they're from South London and wherever Sam Morsi's from. So I think we do need to spend some time working with them. And it's not, and education, the term education can sound patronizing, like we need to educate them. Well, let's have some real meaningful conversations, and let's do it all the time rather than 5 minutes before you're about to enter a dressing room and find a rainbow armband on your peg. Because I think that's probably what happens.
Yeah.
And so it's hard to, you know, you're making that decision in a split second.
Chris, it's always good to have you on. My dad has been in touch, who is an equally optimistic Tottenham fan, who says, crazy exciting game, need a run of wins, fine goal difference, he says. You know, these are the things that matter as a Tottenham fan. He says, not over yet.
Go on, Rushton Senior. Cheers, exactly. Guys. See you later.
We'll chat you soon. Take care, Chris Parris there. And that'll do for part one. We'll begin part two with Nottingham Forest win at Old Trafford.
Die KI-Teammitglieder von Asana verknüpfen ihre Ziele mit relevanten Projekten. So ist jedem Team seine Rolle im Gesamtbild klar. Asana, die führende Plattform für KI-gestütztes Workmanagement. Jetzt kostenlos testen auf asana.com.
Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. So Manchester United 2, Nottingham Forest 3. We'll get to Dan Ashworth in a second. Two defeats in 4 days for Manchester United after that loss to Arsenal. Ruben Amorim not having that new manager bounce. We've discussed this before. It's like a new manager boof or thud or something. Anyway, Will, you were there. How was it?
Really, really wet and cold. It was horrible. Yeah. In these sort of big modern stadiums, you don't expect the rain and wind in your face in the press box. I mean, they should cover it, really, if they're letting us in for free. Obviously, we'll start off talking about United. I think it's starting to show the problems of bringing a manager in mid-season and, you know, should have sacked Ten Hag in the summer and started afresh and given Amorim time to plan. Because he's inherited this squad where it doesn't really fit his 3-4-3 system, but he's going to really stick with that plan. And I think one of the big issues at the moment is he's just changing the defence every week. He's trying to work out his best three into that. It was Yoro, De Ligt and Martinez, but then he had to take two of them off after 65 minutes. And he puts a bit of blame on that, on the fact that they're not fit enough to do 90, but you know, defenders really should be. They're not doing as much running as everyone else. And they spent most of the first half just passing it around between them. I think the top three passing combinations was just the back three between themselves, which is worrying when you're trying to score goals. And that's creating confusion at the back. And so if you look at the goals, obviously set piece again, problematic, too easy for Milenkovic. The Wood goal was, I think, we'll say hilarious. No one taking responsibility for that. I mean, a looping header to the back post. De Ligt just went, nah, no, it's nothing to do with me, mate. And Arna went, yeah, someone will sort it. And then Martinez just went, nah, I can't even be bothered. And I think he's really just got to back a defensive three and stick with it, whatever happens, because the foundation of all teams is a good defence, as Ange Postecoglou might try and tell you. And yeah, I think that's, you know, the key issue. There is a plan at United now, which you didn't see in Ten Hag. You can see what they're trying to do. It's just not working because He's got 1 day a week on the training ground with them between playing, you know, Wednesday, Saturday or Thursday, Sunday. So there's so little time to implement his ideas that it's all just looking a bit half-assed at the moment. No one really sort of knowing what's happening. You know, against Everton, Rashford scored two, Xerxes scored two, and then they've been not started the next two games. So, you know, it's it's an interesting one. And I think United are just going to have to give it a lot of time and wait till the end of the season when Amrin can actually get some time with the players. Because in the meantime, I think you're just going to get periods like this where you beat Everton 4-0 and then the next week you get done by a well-organised Forest team because, you know, they know what they're doing, they've stuck to their plan. Nuno's had time to settle into a formation, different patterns, you know. They play very differently against Ipswich last week, so they did at United, so they did at Liverpool when they won. And United really just couldn't cope with that level of organisation at the moment. So good luck, Ruben.
I mean, I did like Fraser saying, was Nuno Espirito Santo finally exacting revenge on Ruben Amorim 14 years later? The best thing to happen this weekend, a tweet from Michael Cox from the 21st of March 2010. Benfica 1, Porto 0. Ruben Amorim's weak 25-yard shot along the ground is somehow spilled into his own net by Porto's second-choice keeper, Nuno. So is that... So I imagine Nuno seems too old to be playing in that game, but I suppose keepers do play till they're old. I mean, speaking of keepers, Lars, Andre Onana's sort of just sitting down for Morgan Gibbs-White's shot was really tremendous entertainment.
It was a bit of a parallel to that Nuno fumble, actually. It looked a little bit similar, though Amorim's shot was from much further out. Yeah, there was some. Yeah, Angel Di Maria played that game.
Right.
He's still at it. So, you know, we're talking about, you know, Pablo Aimar played. He's not currently at it. David Luiz, I think he's still knocking about. He was in that game back in 2010. I was looking up the line because I also saw that tweet and I checked up the lineups. And yeah, that made me nostalgic for a time when I was less, you know, old, I guess. But I think you just kind of misread. You know, they have to react very, very quickly, these goalkeepers. He probably looks at Morgan Gibbs-White's body shapes and thinks it's coming to one side, and then he doesn't adjust when it comes pretty much straight ahead instead, and it looks really clumsy, but yeah, not great for him. Nuno being famously the sad Jedi, maybe there was some kind of mind trick going on there from the sideline. Maybe that was Nuno, like, doing a wave with his hand, and then Onana went to the other side. Maybe that's what happened.
You made a good point, Barry, yesterday about, you know, Chris Wood becoming Nottingham Forest's all-time Premier League record goal scorer with just 25 goals.
It doesn't seem like much, does it? And it isn't. Yeah, I think Nigel Clough would like a word, among others, whose careers didn't coincide with the invention of football in 1992. Or didn't span the pre-existence of football and the existence of football. Yeah, 25. It's not a record I'd be braying about. Put it that way.
No.
But it was. He is, which is not to take away from Chris Wood, who's having a very good season.
He really is. Ryan says, "Will poor Jim Ratcliffe ever find people up to his high standards to run his football club, or will he keep being let down by other people's incompetence?" John says, "Is Barry surprised to be so quickly vindicated in his belief that Ineos are a total clown show?" So look, he's done us with this to leave his role as Manchester United sporting director after 5 months by mutual agreement. General understanding is it wasn't mutual, and that Omar Berada didn't like him, or there was a personal clash, and that Dan Ashworth wanted Gareth Southgate or didn't want someone who played three at the back. They paid £3 million to get him out of Newcastle. Then they gave Ten Hag a new deal. Then they got rid of Ten Hag to bring in Amorim. It cost £21.4 million to sack Eric Ten Hag as their manager and hire Amorim. It is, Barry, quite funny.
Oh, it's hilarious and entirely predictable. I don't want to go, "I told you so," but I did say so at the time when, as soon as I saw Brailsford sniffing around Old Trafford. Anyone who follows professional cycling will not be surprised by what is happening at Old Trafford. When Ineos bought and took over an all-conquering Sky cycling team, they reduced it to staggering mediocrity in very quick order. Ineos cycling team have just actually lost their best rider, who was on a long contract, but he's gone, Tom Pidcock. But we're not here to talk about cycling. We're talking about Ineos and the mess they're making of Old Trafford. Now, you've listed all the incidences of bungling incompetence. Then you also have the penny pinching, which rising ticket prices unnecessarily, with Sir Jim Ratcliffe giving it the old, I grew up on a council estate in Manchester, I know what it's like to be a fan. No, you don't. And, you know, he's saying, I don't want to price the ordinary working man out of being able to go to Old Trafford. Well, why are you doing it then? Because that is what he's doing. He's also more or less said he has zero interest in the women's team. He's made 250 staff redundant. The savings he's making there can't be worth the goodwill he's losing. And this hiring and firing of Dan Ashworth is... It just looks ridiculous. It's quite embarrassing. But as our listener has pointed out, none of this is Jim Ratcliffe's fault. He's just surrounded by idiots who he happened to appoint.
Well, I got to see almost the sacking live because Ashworth was frog marched through the press conference room to Berada's office, and then very soon after, frog marched back to the director's box and sent on his way.
Did he have a box of things?
A plant and a golf club.
Don't think he's had time to accrue anything. Yeah. He still had his club tie on when he left, so that was, maybe he gets to keep that.
Toss the club tie in a fit of fury at the that would be very good if he was marched through the press area and he came back, he was kind of throwing the club tie around just very angrily. That would have been much better.
His mood hadn't changed from walking past us one way to the other, so I suspect I think he's quite relieved that he's leaving with his reputation vaguely intact, that really, I think this is a lot on Sir Jim's irritations. You know, there's a lot of tension around United still. It's a long-term project and they don't seem to accept that, like changing ticket prices mid-season. I've never even heard that before in my life. But yeah, there's a lot of irritation that, you know, you hire someone like Dan Ashworth with a massive reputation, and everyone I've spoken to speaks very highly of him, and he'll walk away and get a very good job somewhere else. And then within 5 months, he's gone. The staff at United think it just reflects very badly on the club as a whole. They think, well, we've been sold this new project, and again, you know, how do we trust the next one if someone else comes in or someone else got new ideas? And that's, you know, problematic. They've made 250 people redundant or have left, depending on your terminology. And I suspect Sir Jim wants to cut it down a bit more, which would be fun. You know, there's players in the canteen at Carrington, you know, not getting their food quick enough because there's not enough chefs and things like that. The professionalism is sort of waning somewhat, I would argue. And Sir Jim's got a big job on his hands, I appreciate that, but he's making some odd decisions and he seems to want to make a lot of them himself now, when there's however much money you make in business, football's a lot different. And he's taken control. You know, he's got rid of consultants this week. He doesn't want external consultants in helping United and things like that. So, yeah, big decisions, and I think they'll keep coming. And I suspect it'll end with United finishing about ninth this season.
Mm. Just on, what is the point of, what was Dan Ashworth, the point of him, if it wasn't to choose the next manager? Now, that's the sort of, what's Omar Berada doing? Does anybody know? Like, do they need somebody there if Berada's going to go to Portugal and get their new manager?
Well, this is where, as much as it looks shambolic because he was hired at great expense and with some difficulty, it looks nonsensical that he's left already. But if he is supposed to be the director of football and he's not the point man for decisions like that, if that's going to bypass him and go, then he should leave, because then there's really no point in him being there. And really, there's no shortage of men in suits in football who are kind of happy to just take the paycheck and say the right things to their bosses and just kind of let things tick along. So I guess if we give him some credit for not wanting to be part of that sort of thing. Like, there was a photo of the new man in United hierarchy earlier. I think it was Mark Ogden who posted on Twitter of like sort of Ratcliffe and Brailsford and Berada and Ashworth and all the lads. And it did remind me of like an old black and white photo from Stalin's funeral when you had the whole sort of Politburo kind of standing there looking glum. And you kind of wonder, it did occur to me at the time, like, do all these people do something? Like, isn't it probably going to be big Sir Jim with Dave Brailsford in his ear making most of the decisions at the end of the day anyway? And yeah, maybe having one of the dudes from the Politburo leave is not the worst thing that could happen. I think the good news for many United fans is that Sir Jim Ratcliffe, I think he has diagnosed the problem, because he said of United, he said, they're in quite a big pickle as a business. They haven't got the manager selection right. They haven't bought well. They've been the dumb money. The problem is he said that in 2019 in an interview with The Times. Seems to still be true, though now he is the one doing the pickling, as it were.
Let's go to Selhurst Park. Crystal Palace 2, Man City 2. Man City having to come from behind twice to get a point at Palace. Staggering stat of match of the day that they are one of the four sides to have conceded the most big chances this season alongside Ipswich, Leicester and Southampton. Will, as a Man City fan, how do you sort of view the situation?
Really good point at Palace. City are back. Yeah. A win and a draw in a week. This is good stuff. I will put it down on Rodri being absent, really. I know it's simplistic, but on a team sense, not having him on the pitch, and there's no one to replace him in the squad, which then obviously goes back to a recruitment issue. But losing him as such a talismanic figure in the team, I think just drops your confidence a few levels, especially when you know that the other people aren't up to that job, unfortunately. However good Gundogan is at what he does, however good Lewis is at the moment, you're still worried because of that. So the defence are worried, the rest of the forward line are a bit worried. And that's it. So, yeah, the issues really go back to recruitment, that we never had a second player there. We tried Phillips, and from day one, it was obvious that didn't work. So not going out to find someone else is an issue. We brought in Nunes as a midfielder that, you know, barely getting a kick for most of the season. I know he played at the weekend, but yeah, I think it just, to say, it's a Rodri problem and then a longer-term recruitment issue that could have been addressed, because Rodri was complaining about being quite tired for a long time. Obviously, that doesn't mean that you're going to do your ACL, but it really needed someone to step in and go, we need to find a number two to make sure we can, A, take the burden off him a little bit, and if the worst happens, i.e. he's out for a season, although Rodri does think he can come back earlier than planned, then, yeah, they needed someone else that could step in, because clearly they haven't got that.
Yeah, so it doesn't feel like an empire collapsing to you.
Yeah, 7 years of nigh-on constant success, 8 years. So, you know, football is fickle, and errors have been made in recruitment, as I've said. I think, you know, the fact that we only really own one proper fullback in Kyle Walker. Guardiola's very good at left-back, but, you know, there's no sort of depth there. You know, it's a very small squad. You sell in Alvarez and not replacing him. If Haaland gets injured now and we end up with no Haaland and no Rodri, you know, we might as well give up. You know, Scott Carson might as well play. And that's it. So, you know, Guardiola likes to take risks in these things. He likes a small squad, but again, you might need a bit more pragmatism when it comes to those things. And it's not as if they're short of money. You know, they're very joyful to explain how much profit was made over the past 12 months every time. So, yeah, I think it's an issue, and these things will be addressed in the summer, because it's very hard to do so in January, as however many people City will be linked with. I mean, you just have to take it as a sort of rough and tumble of being an elite Premier League team. And I suspect now success will be finishing third or fourth.
Rico Lewis was sent off. After the game, Pep was at his most annoying, sort of suggesting that there's a global agenda against Rico Lewis or something to that effect. I wondered what you made of that.
Yeah, that was really funny. I think he's taken this sort of jibe that holding the fingers up at Anfield was a bit Mourinho-esque. He's really taken that to heart, because I thought that was they were not just what, I mean, this answer was a work of art, really, from Guardiola, even if it wasn't like linguistically amazing, and in his English is better than my Spanish, obviously. But he suggested in the same answer both, he both suggested that there was an agenda against Rico Lewis. He said, because this Rico is what this is. But he also tried to do the Mourinho thing of turning the question back on the questionnaire, which Mourinho always does when he's in trouble. He'll say, oh, did you think it was a... Yeah, he did the thing of asking the reporter, did you think there was a yellow card? So in one answer, he both did a Mourinho thing of turning the question back onto the reporter, and he also did a Mourinho thing of, like, inventing a completely nonsensical conspiracy that doesn't exist. So I think he's really, like, they want me to be like Mourinho, I will show them me being like Mourinho. Because that was 10 out of 10. Pep goes full Mourinho, I thought.
Let's do the two ridiculous late comebacks on Sunday, Barry, starting with Leicester-Brighton. An amazing end to this game, sort of virtually out of nowhere, with Jamie Vardy the eternal Jamie Vardy just at the centre of things.
Yeah, can I just formally apologise to all Crystal Palace fans for giving them no credit whatsoever between the four of us for their fine draw against Man City?
You're right to do so.
I don't quite know how Brighton failed to win that game, because they were in almost total control for 88 minutes or whatever it was. And then ended up in a right old dither by the end of it. They were really clinging on and could have lost it. So it's a good point for Leicester. Brighton will wonder how on earth they didn't win. And I thought Brighton's equaliser was excellent. I mean, Jamie Vardy really showed his experience. A Leicester striker might have taken a shot just for the sake of taking a shot from a difficult angle with a goalkeeper in the way, but he had the smarts to pull the ball inside so Decordova Reed could slot it home. And yeah, that's
100%, yeah,
a great show of experience from Vardy, who I have to say I thought he would be just too old to have any impact for Leicester this season, but he's still got it.
Yeah, worth mentioning Tarik Lamptey's opener as well. Actually, both Brighton goals were brilliant in this game. Bournemouth took their time, Lars, but they won late on. It's just agonising, this Ipswich. They've done so well in this game.
Yeah, it's obviously rough for Ipswich, having been ahead for that long. But I also think being sort of cold and unfeeling, and overall, Bournemouth had a lot of chances in this game, and it wasn't undeserved as a result. Bournemouth are good, man. Bournemouth are really good. They've been ticking along very nicely for quite a long time now. And being a man of sort of occasionally stats curious, as I am, they've got the second best XG difference in the league now. Like, Bournemouth's numbers are brilliant. And yeah, I do worry for them if this kind of Spurs situation spirals out of control for Ange Postecoglou. I suspect Iraola would be very high on their wish list if there was to become a change there in the next couple of months.
All right, that'll do for part two. Part three, we'll begin with Fulham's draw with Arsenal. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Moonlight Hanger says, do Arsenal need to hire a specialist open play coach? they drew at Fulham. Raul Jimenez, brilliant early strike, which was Fulham's first meaningful bit of doing anything in the game. Cancelled out by William Saliba scoring from a set piece. A fair result, Will, do you think?
Fulham, although the stats might tell you differently, I think they had a 0.1 XG, which is quite a feat. But fair play to Raul Jimenez to making the most of that.
That is low, yeah.
But I don't think Fulham really had too many problems overall. They're well organised. Marco Silva is probably a bit of an underrated manager. You know, we talk about Iraola, but the quality that Fulham showed to be organised, to know what was coming, to send Traore to man-mark everyone and see if he can wrestle them off the pitch. You know, it's all good thinking. Yeah, Arsenal had a lot of the ball, but overall, I think Fulham did what they needed to do against a team with far better players than them and kept them out, and it would have been a bit upsetting if the disallowed goal had been given in the end. Arsenal, very good at set pieces. I mean, maybe they should just turn into a set piece like concept, you know, sod the rest of football, and maybe, you know, one team gets a corner, the other team gets a corner, we just sort of do that. That might get the YouTube generation in, cut down football a bit.
The Arsenal Globetrotters just going around putting on exhibitions of set pieces.
Welcome to Pasadena, as Declan Rice and Bukayo Saka are here with Gabriel in the middle, and there's a crowd of 350,000. I mean, it is worth it. You know, they weren't quite at it, Baz, you know, on the pitch. I can't remember who it was the other day said, you know, in the previous two games before the United game, Odegaard and Saka had been so brilliant.
I think this isn't necessarily a bad result for Arsenal, you know, away from home, a decent team. But it's a real frustrating one, because they had a chance to make up 3 points on Liverpool. They missed some good chances. Rice should have scored. Partey should have scored from a corner. That's the second one he's missed in two games. Two pretty straightforward chances. And, sorry, Gabriele Martinelli, you should not be offside there. You're looking along the line, you shouldn't be offside. That was, you know, a foolish misstep on his part, and it cost his side the win.
On these famous Arsenal set pieces, which they're obviously very, very good at, there was one moment in this game where Adama Traore, I think it was, just kind of really did the reverse block. You know, there's a lot of blocking moves going on Arsenal set pieces, and he sort of turned the table on them. And I think it was Timber, he just kind of pushed off the field. Good defending, obviously, but it made me think, and this is not targeted at Arsenal specifically, but I think that's the way the laws of the game are now. There's a huge incentive for the attacking team to really try to bend the rules on these corners, because the worst thing that can happen is that you get a foul and you lose a corner, and that's no problem. But the problem for the defense, I thought this when Traore kind of... You risk giving away a penalty, right? For the defender, it's really dangerous to try to like push and pull, especially when we got VAR now. Whereas for the attackers, again, you don't really risk much. So I feel like that it goes back to one of, I think, mine, and can I maybe extend this to our hobby horses on the pod, which is Doyle's Law, the idea that maybe innocuous fouls in the box that doesn't stop a clear goal-scoring opportunity maybe shouldn't be a penalty, because it's another little reason why I don't like that.
Yeah, it's interesting, because when you watch Cucurella for Chelsea, what he does is he runs to the keeper, is a bit annoying, and then just runs away before the ball sort of got there. So he's been annoying.
Yeah.
He has impacted what happens to the keeper, but not so much that it's a foul.
Yeah.
But like the keeper can't just go sod off, or Jack Stevens can't pull his hair, obviously.
Well, that's the thing. If you're Spurs, you kind of want Romero to sort him out when he's doing that, but then you risk giving away a penalty. So, like, it's kind of the way the laws are. With, again, it comes down to this: every little foul in the box ends up being 80% chance of a goal to the attacking team. Mm. It gives you such a huge, like, you can start the wrestling match in the box as the attacking team and not risk anything, whereas giving anything back as the defending team is a hugely dangerous thing to do. And it kind of,
yeah.
I'm not blaming Arsenal at all for exploiting this. It's very clever, but it feels like a bit of a problem with the laws and the refereeing.
Yeah.
Go to the other extreme, and that if it's a foul in either box, it's a penalty to whoever was the victim of that foul. So
wow,
you're fine.
That's big.
Take yeah.
Well, no, I was just wondering, is it actually just to say, like, and this is kind of what happens, just a certain amount of grappling is kind of fine.
Like, yeah, but we don't really want wrestling matches in there either, do we? It's kind of funny, I guess, well, but it's not.
Gabriel's been dropped for Rowdy Roddy Piper is an issue, isn't it?
I just think if this is me fully departing the box here, which is not what I typically do. I tend to be sort of voice of reason, but I tend to think like penalties. You should change the laws so that it's only a penalty if you're stopping a clear goal scoring opportunity. And all these accidental handballs and niggly fouls could be like indirect free kicks or something, with the added bonus that indirect free kicks are really fun. And you could have a whole new sort of range of specialists for that as well.
Oh,
we could have the set piece coach, the indirect set piece coach, you know, even more fun.
Brentford 4, Newcastle 2. So 8 home games so far this season. They've won 7 and drawn 1. In only 2 of those games, Brentford have scored fewer than 3. So the opening day victory over Palace and a 1-1 draw with West Ham. In their last 5 home games, there have been 31 goals. Away from home, they have 1 point, a goalless draw at Goodison Park. But they're 7th in the table. Like, can a team qualify for Europe without winning a game away from home? And Barry, if Thomas Frank doesn't know why they're so good at home and not away, how can we be expected to know?
Yeah, he was asked afterwards why, to explain the disparity between their home performances and their away performances. He just said he had no idea. And I don't know either. I mean, they were helped here by a pretty dismal Newcastle effort, another one to add to an increasingly and worrying long list for Newcastle fans. They've got 2 points from the last 4 games, I think 20 points from the past 15. They seem to turn up for the big home games, but not these sort of bread and butter matches. They tend not to be very good in London anyway, if I'm correct. I haven't checked the stats, but that's my firm belief, and I will happily be shot down. And they were pretty poor here again, not pressing with any kind of intensity, missing tackles all over the place defensively. And they're massively inconsistent under Eddie Howe at the moment. And I think there is some quite an increasingly loud murmur of dissatisfaction about what he's getting out of this team at the moment. But hats off to, this was textbook Brentford at home performance. Mbeumo scores, Wissa scores, two great goals. But yeah, Brentford were very much helped on this occasion by Newcastle.
You know, I can tentatively attempt, I can try to explain the home and away split here just by reading off some fixtures. At home, Brentford have played so far in the league Crystal Palace, Southampton, West Ham, Wolves, Ipswich, Bournemouth, Leicester, and now Newcastle. Away from home, they have played Liverpool, Man City, Tottenham, United, Fulham, Everton, and Aston Villa. And in that draw against Everton, they had a red card in the first half. So I mean, Thomas Frank doesn't want to say this on Match of the Day, but I think the explanation is pretty simple. They've played some pretty average teams at home, and they've played some really difficult teams away. It is still a little bit more extreme than you'd expect, but I think a lot of it just comes down to the fixture list.
Good point, well made. Thank you for explaining it, Lars. The mystery is, we wanted some mystery, and now we have none, Lars. You've ruined it.
That's what I'm here for.
To Villa Park, then finally, Villa 1, Southampton 0. Probably the least interesting, perhaps the wettest game, windiest game of the day. I love John McGinn saying, we walked out of the first half, the wind was against us. We walked out of the second half and the wind was against us still. you know, it, like that's that is two good results in a row. It's two wins they should have had, Will, but they've done it in the last two games, and you know, that is good.
Yeah, all these old stadia where the sides are still open so you can get the wind in. Absolutely fuming. I'm sure Ben Fisher was sat there getting soaked, so he kept covering his laptop desperately as he tried to type about Southampton, desperately passing it around at the back, hoping it might work finally. Yeah, Aston Villa, again, shows a, go back to City, shows a good idea of having two top-quality strikers that you can interchange. You know, Duran absolutely bullied Taylor Harwood-Bellis on that. Southampton again got their philosophy, sticking with it, causing them problems, very much going down regardless of what happens at this point. But Villa, I think, are finding their feet a little bit, trying to get used to that rhythm of playing Champions League, Premier League, and using their squad a bit smarter than maybe they were at the start of the season. And say, when you've got strikers capable like Duran, who, you know, I think would walk into everyone's starting lineup sort of outside the top four, maybe, you know, it's a positive sign that things are probably calming down after a questionable start. I saw the Palace game and there was definitely some issues within the Villa team. But yeah, they seem to be rectifying it and they've got a stronger bench than Tottenham, I'll say that for nothing.
I can't watch Taylor Harwood-Bellis now without looking at his every error through the prism of him being Roy Keane's future son-in-law. And I suspect now that if there was lunch at Keane Towers yesterday, Roy would have had him out in the back garden, you know, instructing him in how not to be bullied by John Duran next time a ball is floated over the top.
Do you think there's one of those giant chess sets and Roy Keane makes Taylor Harwood-Bellis stand where the rook should be, and then he's like, this is, you know, this is the bishop is John Duran, and this is what we've got to do. West Ham play Wolves tonight. We'll also talk about that on Wednesday, and we are send our best, of course, to Mikel Antonio after he was involved in that, what looked from the pictures, an absolutely horrific car crash, and to walk out alive looks fortunate, doesn't it, without knowing exactly what happened. A statement from West Ham over the weekend said he's in a stable condition, conscious and communicating, currently under close supervision at a central London hospital. He's undergone surgery on a lower limb fracture, will be monitored in hospital over the coming days. But yeah, not a a bad word to be said about Mikel Antonio across the footballing world. So we send him our love and our best. And finally, from panellist Sam Dalling, says, a question for the pod. Last Tuesday, I attended Salford v Harrogate as a guest of Will Unwin. Blimey. At halftime, my wife offered Will a hot drink as a way of relaying our thanks for sorting our date night. Will's reply was, just hot water, please. I carry my own bags, before whipping out a Sainsbury's Taste the Difference lemon and ginger number. Is this socially acceptable behaviour at League 2 level, or indeed any level? Will, thoughts?
Well, first, thanks to Sam for inviting me into his romantic life. Nice to be a third party on date night. Actually, he's wrong.
Salford Harrogate. If I took Mrs. Rushton to Salford Harrogate, I took her to the Ashes on Boxing Day, and we left at lunch because she hated cricket. So blimey, at the MCG. Anyway, do carry on.
Actually, he's factually incorrect. It was lemon, ginger, and manuka honey.
Right. Okay.
Obviously, there were no herbal teas, as far as I was aware, at Salford. And obviously, I don't drink caffeine after lunch, so it was a very sensible policy. And they kindly sold Sam's wife a cup of hot water, and I put it in, and I drank it.
How much they charge you for a cup of hot water?
Well, I didn't buy it, did I? I don't know. Maybe it was free. Maybe I don't need to thank you.
Surely that's for free. Hopefully the class of 92 should get some herbal tea in.
Jim Ratcliffe would charge it. He'd charge you 10 quid for a cup of hot water.
I was in the Harrogate away end, so... Harrogate is well known for its tea rooms. I thought it was a nice little nod, you know. Really,
do you think Harrogate take a Betty's tea room with them for away games? You can always get a scone and jam, can you?
The shame is on Sam and his wife for refusing to buy me a lovely scone. I mean, I've done my bit to respect Harrogate and their long tradition of teas, and yeah, it was lovely. I was warm. He got a free ticket. I don't know what he's complaining. Thanks to Guardian Football Week listener James Belshaw for the free tickets as well. He's not thanked him. And yeah, it's a shame that Harrogate were terrible and got beat 2-0, but you know, swings and roundabouts.
So Will seems to be really abusing his position for free hot water and kickbacks of other...
Oh yeah, I've got no soul. I'm morally bankrupt. Don't worry about that. Yeah, free tickets to Harrogate away and lemon and ginger and manuka teas. Yeah.
This is sleaze.
This is
sleaze and cronyism.
What a lovely place to end. And that'll do for today. Thank you, Barry.
Thank you.
Cheers, Lars.
Thank you, Max.
Thank you, Will.
Thanks, Max. Available for all freebies.
Football Weekly is produced by Joel Grove. Our executive producer is Danielle Stevens.
This is The Guardian.